Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I am your host, Jackie Canterbury. My guest today is Dr. Eric Wagner. Eric is a writer and seabird biologist with the Center for Ecosystem Sentinels at the University of Washington. It's here he studies penguin colonies in Argentina and, closer to home, rhinoceros auklets at two island colonies, Protection and Destruction Islands. The Center for Ecosystem Sentinels, which I looked up a couple days ago, it's just really fantastic. It's the University of Washington. It really specializes in research, and it's a research organization dedicated to studying sentinel species. So we're going to talk about what that means a little bit later on. But Eric has written four books, and today we're really focusing and talking with him about his latest book, which is called Seabirds as Sentinels. Here, joins a team of scientists studying auklets and other seabirds to understand environmental changes occurring in the ocean. And here again today, we're going to focus on Protection and Destruction Islands. And actually, he just got back from a trip to Protection, so it'll be very interesting. The central idea is that seabirds function as sentinels, or early warning indicators of changes in marine ecosystems. The North Pacific is one of the most productive ecosystems on Earth. I mean, this is where we live. Its waters support salmon, whales, seals, countless seabirds, and the human communities that depend on them. Yet this remarkable ecosystem, as we all know, is undergoing unprecedented changes, and seabirds can reflect that and really provide some of the clearest signals of what lie ahead. So that gives you an idea of what Eric's book is about and what we're going to focus on today. And question number one is the title of the book, Seabirds as Sentinels. I really liked that title, and it's immediately intriguing. When did you choose that title, and why are seabirds such a powerful lens through which to understand changes in the ocean?
That's a great question, and thanks very much for having me.
You're very welcome.
So Seabirds as Sentinels as a title, and why are seabirds such great sentinels? I mean, one of the things is that, I mean, just about seabirds in general, is that they're just such beautiful creatures. I mean, you have everything from penguins, which I study, which are aerially flightless, all the way up to albatrosses with wingspans of 12 feet flying thousands of miles. And so there's something about the sort of the breadth of their biology and ecology that makes them very just sort of compelling characters. And also in the sense that they live, they exist and persist at the top, often near the top of food webs. And so many of the changes that are occurring at sort of lower trophic levels, like things that radiate up from phytoplankton to zooplankton to small fish to all the things that seabirds eat and need to live, they manifest in a seabird's life, you know, and how well it is able to raise chicks and how long it lives, and whether or not it gets covered with oil and whether or not it gets caught as a bycatch in a fishery. And so because of that visibility, you know, that makes them fascinating to look at, fascinating to study, and fascinating to try to learn from. And so that's how that idea of the sentinel species and seabirds as being excellent sentinels, that's where it comes from.
It's a really catchy title. And also, does climate change enter that equation at all?
Oh, of course. So that's one of the things where often seabirds are responding to fairly small changes. You know, a lot of there's some interesting things about seabird life history in that they're a long-lived species. You know, many live, you know, you've heard of Wisdom the albatross, who's been breeding for something like 60 years.
Yes.
The penguins I study, they can live for 30 years or more. And so seabirds are kind of, they're built for dynamic environment. Their biology accommodates this notion that they're going to be good years and bad years. And so a certain amount of variability is expected. You know, they're not always going to be able to raise as many chicks as they would like. But it seems like lately, owing to a number of climate factors, you know, increased marine temperatures, shifting prey ranges, that climate change is really becoming, is a huge factor in seabird sort of life history and conservation. And so, you know, within the Salish Sea, we're seeing warming waters and shifting prey movements, and on the outer coast as well, species changing in sort of space and time.
And how long have these prey movements been changing? Do you have a time frame for that?
The one that I think of that immediately comes to mind is with the auklets. So with the auklets, the sort of the main character of the book, and their colony at Destruction Island. So the folks that I was writing about, Scott Pearson and Peter Hodum and Tom Goode, have been working at Destruction since 2008. And they've been doing diet sampling with the auklets to see what species they're eating. And in the early years, it was mostly anchovy dominated. There were northern anchovies were what the auklets seemed to be catching mostly. But in the last few years, it's been surf smelts or different types of smelts. So the anchovy largely disappeared. Where did they go? I personally don't know. I'm sure there's somebody out there who knows. Actually, but it turns out that this year they kind of started to come back. To go from a anchovy-dominated diet to a smelt-dominated diet, that was one sort of sign of how...
Yeah, shifting.
How these things are shifting. Mm-hmm. There are two types of fish that they eat all the time. One is Pacific sand lance and the other is herring. And those have been pretty steady. So it's like you can have these two colonies that are actually fairly close to each other, you know, that aren't that, you know, I think it's like 70 miles apart if you just draw a line between them. But they're in two almost completely different systems.
That's amazing, actually. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the rhinoceros auklet, and I noted in the book that you focus on the rhinoceros auklet. And here, if you take the ferry from here over to Whidbey, most of the time you will see them in large numbers because of the fact that they go in their burrows, right, at night, and then they come out during the day. Mm-hmm. I read in your book that, you know, I knew that the auklet is part of a very large family of alcids. Mm-hmm. They evolved between 54 and 70 million years ago from a single ancestor.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that totally blew me away.
Yeah.
It makes me feel very small, which I do already.
Yeah.
But why are they such effective sentinels of ocean health?
Well, it's interesting. So when I was starting this book, I really wanted to focus on the auklet, on the rhinoceros auklet, because it doesn't get a ton of attention.
You're right.
Most people, when you think of alcids or auks, the one that everybody really likes is the puffin around here, tufted puffins. And also, you know, they think of MERS. But because auklets, as you say, you know, they're largely nocturnal, at least in their land practices. So you're more likely to see them out on the water where there's this kind of short gray thing tottering around.
Right, with a little...
Yeah, with a nice little horn.
Nice little horn.
And it's interesting because auklets actually are fairly closely related to puffins. They're more closely related to puffins than they are to other auklets, like least auklets or whiskered auklets or whatever. And so one of their old names used to be the rhinoceros puffin or the gray puffin.
Okay.
Before genetically they were identified to be completely, you know, their own genus. Why are they so effective as sentinels? In part because of their ubiquity. Puffins are also effective sentinels, but they are disappearing from these waters. There's only one real colony left, I think, in the Salish Sea. And then the ones on the outer coast in Washington are rapidly shrinking, and the puffin has disappeared from somewhere, you know, some very depressing percentage of its former haunts in Oregon and Washington. But the auklet has persisted. You know, one of the things that's interesting is to sort of compare and contrast the auklet and the puffin and see why one is more stable and the other is not. And I know that Scott, Peter, and Tom, one of the reasons they started looking at the auklet was to see, was that very reason, was here is a species that has, you know, superficially the same profile in biology as the puffin, but is doing better than the puffin. And what, you know, how might the auklets help explain the puffin's disappearances?
And what has caused specific, I'm sure it's very complex, so that's you know, what are some of the factors, I should say, that have caused the disappearance of the puffin?
There are a lot. It's thought that it's harder for them to find prey. The Washington puffins were hit fairly hard by an oil spill several years ago, and there was some loss there. One of the things that people suspect, or at least this is a rationale that was given when the federal government decided not to list the puffin as endangered, was that it's undergoing a range contraction. You know, this was sort of the southern limit of their range, and so it's just sort of withdrawing up while there's still a pretty robust population up in Alaska or in the Gulf of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, there are a lot of reasons, and it's hard to point to one and say this is why. I think it's one of the things where, you know, when you search for proximal causes, what you really find are these sort of layers acting together in different ways. And so, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And that's why conservation and prevention is the key. that you just don't want to take any chances with these habitats and change them in any way, because oftentimes it is habitat loss. And, you know, two of the book's central settings, of course, are Destruction Island and Protection Island. And I'd like you to describe these places. I actually have been fortunate enough to go out there and boat. I took a class with the Land Trust, and their first class was going out there, and I was with some fish and wildlife people that were so knowledgeable about the area. But I'd like you to describe these places for our listeners and explain why they are so important to your research. And what I'm going to do is just start and read just a small passage in your book, because I thought it was so beautiful, and particularly Protection Island, which is close to where we all live. But let me read a description from page 83 of the book. I really just like, I compliment you. It's just wonderful.
Thank you.
So it's on page 83. A large wooden sign welcomes us to the Protection Island National Wildlife Refuge, informs us that the refuge was established on August 26, 1988. In the heart of the breeding season, the island is a riot of birds. Next to the inlet is a large colony of glaucous-winged gulls, hundreds of which fly overhead, while others perch on the breakwater. There are also pigeon guillemots, which breed here by the hundreds, swimming around the docks. Fish dangle from a few of their bills, and I can so see that. Sculpin, other creatures of the rock bottoms. Of course, there is no sign of the tens of thousands of auklets that burrow in the slope. In late morning, they have already left. Tall grasses ripple in the breeze. It's in late morning sun. The scene looks like something Andrew Wyeth might have painted. Dark trees sparkle in the island's northern fringe. They seem rather haphazardly distributed, Vancouver also noted. So if you could also just follow up and give us a, that's just a beautiful description.
Thank you. So they're two very different places. Protection Island is, it's in the Salish Sea. It's about a mile off the northern coast of Washington. It's very close to Squim. It's very visible from a lot of the communities along the north coast of the Olympic Peninsula. It's a fairly large island. I think it's about 400 acres in size. It's a sandstone composite-y sort of thing, very flat top mostly. And it is hosts one of the largest auklet colonies in the world. There are some, I think the last count is 35,000 auklet pairs, so 70,000 auklets breeding there, and then some unknown number that aren't breeding but just hanging around. It's covered with grasses, a lot of which are invasive, and the Fish and Wildlife and the Jamestown Sklalom, which is now co-managing the refuge, are working, you know, they're working to try to restore native plants. And the auklets themselves, their burrows are just cover the hillsides. You know, you just, as you boat by the island, you know, people aren't technically allowed to land there, or the public, general public isn't. You can if you're a scientist or one of the managers. But you just see that the slopes are just covered, you know, stippled with little dots, like just all these little holes. And those are all auklet burrows. And it just gives you a sense of how many auklets there are, you know, because, you know, in each one of those burrows is, you know, or not each one, but a substantial proportion of those burrows are full of an egg or a chick or an adult or something. And Destruction is completely different to me in character and aesthetic. It's on the outer coast, about 3 miles offshore. You can see it from places like Ruby Beach or Claylock on, you know, on Highway 101. It's much smaller. I think it's about 33 acres. And the colony there is small too. It's about 6,500 pairs, so around 13,000 auklets, again at last count, which was about a decade ago. It's a lot more rugged in appearance, and the main feature of it is that there's a lighthouse on it. It was the Destruction Island Light that was built in the late 1800s and ran continuously for some number of decades before being turned off. And as a character, it's a lot wilder in aspect to me. It's much harder to move around the island. There's the slopes are steep and friable. The rocks are there. The sea is always pounding. And there's much more of a sense of being of remoteness when you're out there. You know, you look to the west and all you see is ocean just spreading out to the horizon.
And those big waves.
Yeah, the big waves, the noise, the clouds, the sun setting. It's really, it's quite wonderful. The slopes of it are also covered with trees. I mean, very thick willow. And so sort of scrambling around there is difficult. It's just not a, it's not an island that you feel is is very welcoming for humans.
And it's so a wild island then.
It's a very wild island. And protection is interesting because there were movements earlier to build on it. There was a planned community for it. And a lot of the roads that we drive on when we're moving around the island were those, you know, they platted out 700 or 800 properties where people were going to build before. I think they found out that the water wasn't potable. So, which seems like something you'd want to know before you started selling properties, but maybe not. With protection, there's that, it's a little more accommodating. You know, we stay, when we're there, we stay in an old caretaker's cabin. And feel, you know, it's, I can sleep in a bed if I want to, which is a field biologist's rare luxury. There's a lot of one side of a particular type of wilderness coin for each island.
Excellent. And what role does the Fish and Wildlife play? Because I noticed you mentioned Scott, and I did a Nature Now show with him a couple years ago about the Caspian terns, and really enjoyed him immensely. And I know that some of your research is done with Scott. Is that correct?
Yes.
From Fish and Wildlife Service. So what's that role like?
Well, so Scott is with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Fish and Wildlife Service managed Protection Island and now co-manages it with the Jamestown Slalom as of a couple of years ago. And it's interesting, the history of Destruction Island and the Fish and Wildlife Service is a little more complicated in that it was assumed, I think, finding out all these sort of particular twists and turns has been interesting. So the Washington offshore rocks, Quileute Needles, and that was designated as a national wildlife refuge in the early 1900s. But Destruction Island was never part of it. You know, it was part of the Lighthouse Service. It had been reserved as a lighthouse site. And so when the light went off, there was some, and I'm not sure of the exact sort of details here, the island was somehow sort of thought to have been folded in with the other offshore rocks that are part of the wildlife refuge.
Okay.
But then folks realized that it had never been made, you know, that had never been an official act. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service actually doesn't have anything to do with Destruction Island. It's stewarded right now by the U.S. Coast Guard.
Oh.
And so because it's a former Coast Guard sort of station, because the Coast Guard had absorbed the Lighthouse Service, the U.S. Lighthouse Service. Yeah, so just Protection Island is a wildlife refuge.
All right. Taking off on fish. You write that the fate of the rhinoceros auklet is ultimately tied to fish. And you also describe yourself as, at heart, a fish scientist, which I love. How do these two ideas connect?
Well, it sort of gets back to the sentinel idea, because when you study a rhinoceros auklet and you're trying to sort of tease apart what is causing, you know, these sort of ups and downs that you might see, you might be saying sort of superficially, well, how many chicks did the auklets raise? But when you're asking questions about chick survival, what you're really asking most of the time is how much food were the chicks able to get, you know, because they need that to grow and fledge. And so if you're talking about their food, you're really talking about fish. And so if you're talking about fish, then you're talking about what the fish eat. And then it's sort of on down in this sort of great chain of being. So we have proxies that we can use, sort of environmental shortcuts, you can say, sort of sea surface temperature anomalies, for instance, like how much hotter is the water than normal?
Okay.
And then there's an assumption there about how that will manifest in the fish available to the auklets to give to their chicks.
Okay, I see.
And so that's how that works.
So that's how that works.
Yeah.
And you also refer to them as oceanographers.
Yes.
I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah.
For any of you who may just be tuning in, this is Jackie Canterbury with KPTZ's Nature Now program. I am talking with Dr. Eric Wagner about his book, Seabirds as Sentinels. So I found your writing about Cannery Row in Chapter 5 interesting. Uh-huh. Can you talk about how this is a story of forage fish, talk about what a forage fish is, and particularly sardines, and does this have any bearing on possibly what's happening now? Can you translate to current times?
So forage fish are these small schooling fishes, what we think of as sardines or smelts or anchovy or herring. They have a diverse life history. You know, they breed in different ways. They live different lengths of time. They travel. They have different sort of preferences for water temperature and things like that. They're one of those sort of great energetic reservoirs for a lot of what we think of as upper trophic level species, like whales or birds or, you know, salmon and things like that. And so the fate of forage fish you know, really drives a lot of the things that we see and care about in that way. And so Cannery Row, I thought was fascinating to just sort of think of it, you know, I usually try to discourage sort of reading with too focused a lens, you know, I mean, I don't want to be reductive to say that Cannery Row is a book of forage fish, because it, you know, it's a book of a lot of things.
Sure.
But the forage, the sardine fishery sort of underpins a lot of the narrative development in that book, because it's the collapse of the sardine fishery that drives a lot of the characters into their sort of state of, I don't want to say comic, but I'll say comic destitution, mm-hmm. and the, you know, the sort of economic collapse. So how is that manifesting now? Well, it's interesting because there aren't a lot of forage fish fisheries necessarily on the West Coast that I can think of, although probably a fishery scientist could. But you do see their effects sort of manifest through salmon, especially because
yes.
salmon need a lot of forage
they
fish.
They do.
You know, again, what we find is that even if we're not necessarily talking about seabirds or whales or like things that eat lots of herring, we're still talking about things that we really care about, like salmon. These sort of main, you know, the economic drivers, or one of the economic drivers in this region. And yeah, I guess in that sense, I liked Cannery Row because it was about a forage fish. I mean, there are obviously a lot of massive forage fish fisheries all over the world, mm-hmm. you know, in Peru, Enchufeta and south of in Chilean sprats and Anchoita in Argentina and things like that. So forage fish are a huge fishery in their own right. They're fish oil. A lot of fish oil comes from forage fish.
And yeah, and I know herring are, you know, I
suppose. Yes, and herring, you know, we like herring a lot. That
exactly.
Yeah.
So if you could take readers to one place described in your book, and there were a lot of them, which I loved, and actually your work just this week, Monday and Tuesday, out in Protection Island,
yeah, uh-huh.
could you paint a picture, and what would we see, hear, and experience there? Because when I looked at the pictures in your book, it looked like you were flat on the face of the rocks. You had, uh-huh. you know, your helmets on and your lights, and, you know, you want to picture for our audience how deep these burrows go for these auklets.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, you're
yeah.
talking... And then the other thing about it, too, is what does the relationship between being a bird that is somewhat wild,
mm-hmm.
the auklet, and you talk about that in your book, and mm-hmm. also only laying one egg, is that mm-hmm. correct?
Yep.
And then so the reproductive rate is very low,
mm-hmm.
and whenever you have a low reproductive rate, that means almost sure trouble in the end for the species, correct?
Well, it depends. The thing with the auklets is the yeah. one egg isn't necessarily bad because they try to raise one chick a year, and they will do that for several years, you know, 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9 years. So from a, you know, in biology, you kind of talk about replacement rate. You
yes.
need to, if you want a population to grow, you need to have as many children as,
yes.
as you are as parents, or more ideally. And so... You know, the auklets are going to get a number of opportunities to raise one chick to fledging that will then go on to breed. And so in the sense, for things like California condors mm-hmm. or, you know,
yes.
species that are famously not super productive, that is definitely a conservation issue. For the auklet, it's the sort of thing where, you know, there's another auk, and there's another book out by Maria Mudd Ruth called The Bird with Flaming Red Feet. She writes about the pigeon guillemots.
Pigeon guillemots.
Yeah, and the pigeon guillemots lay 2 eggs.
Yes.
And so that's actually a little bit rare among the auk. Puffins lay 1, murres will lay 1. But there are some species that lay 2, and so that's the implication is that because they can potentially raise 2. And so often what will happen is you'll have one egg that hatches first, and so that chick will be bigger than its younger sibling, and so it will have a greater chance of survival. But in really good years, maybe both chicks will survive, and so that's sort of how that system is working. But with the auklet, you know, since they just have one chick, they can pour all of their reproductive energies into that one chick. And so what we've found, at least, is that on both islands, both colonies where we work, reproductive success rates are actually quite high.
Really?
Yeah. And so that's actually, it's one of the things
it's
that's,
nice.
It's almost, yeah, I know you're like, oh, what a pleasant
really?
Surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these birds are actually doing fairly yeah. well. We don't know how the chicks are doing, which is the final sort of test of their sort of reproductive theory, is how many chicks will return.
The return rate.
Yeah. But what we've seen is that occupancy rates are pretty steady. Fledging success rates are pretty high. And so that's one of the things that that makes the auklets, you know, sort of seemingly resilient in the face of some of these more
challenging things. Yeah. And after spending so many years studying these birds and the oceans that they depend on, are you more hopeful or more concerned about the future of marine ecosystems? We'll end on this one, and why?
Yeah, I remain concerned. I think one of the things that we're seeing is that there are more and more extreme climatic events. I talk in the book about marine heat waves.
And yes.
There was the blob that happened a few years ago, the effects of which we're still seeing now. And so when I talk about a species being resilient, I think, you know, I don't know how much we're testing that resiliency in the sense of, I remember looking at images of the sea surface temperature in the height of the blob when the whole sort of Northeast Pacific was this big angry red swath.
Yes.
At the time that was unprecedented, but it was just like that a little while ago. And now as it's predicted that there's an El Nino coming, it may be one of the largest ever, we don't know. You know, I'm concerned. You know, I like these creatures a lot. I love them. You know, I think they're fascinating and wonderful and have their a right to exist just like anything else. And I'd like them to have a good chance of it. And we were just out at protection, which meant we were putting some little tags on the birds, some GPS tags, so we can see where they go to forage. And when you're holding an auklet, you know, it's so small. It's about, in the book, I say it's about the size of a mango. It's maybe a little bit bigger. That would be a large mango. But there's something about the focus of it, you know, when it looks at you. And obviously it's scared when you're holding it, but it's that keenness of the gaze is really something. And the fierceness of its life. I can describe all the scratches on my hand from their little toe claws.
Yes, and you mentioned that in the book about their inherent wildness. That's what I really tuned in on, and that's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, and so I'm rooting for them very, very much, and I want them to continue to be wonderful and be able to live. And so I think, I guess I'll just leave. I'm concerned.
Well, thank you very much. And this has just been a wonderful interview. I can't thank you enough for your time, because I know it took us a long time to get this arranged. And if anybody wants to read an incredible book about seabirds, and remember, it's local, is Seabirds as Sentinels from Eric Wagner, Auklets, Puffins, Shearwaters, and The View. So thank you so very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening today. You can access older and current episodes on the KPTZ website under Nature Now, plus we are on Instagram. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich, and thank you for our ending concert on Zeno Canto for an auklet colony. So be well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.